Mitzvah Shin Lamed Aleph 331. Mitzvahs Tekiyas Shofar B'Yom HaKippurim Shel Yovel. On Yom Kippur, during the Jubilee year, we're supposed to sound the shofar. Litko b'shofar b'asiri b'tishrei shu Yom HaKippurim, on the 10th of Tishrei, which is Yom Kippur, obviously. Shenemar v'ha'avarta shofar tirua. It says explicitly in the Chumash that you're supposed to blow the shofar on that day. B'yom HaKippurim taviru shofar b'chol artzichem. You're supposed to blow the shofar on Yom Kippur. U'krasem jor, and that's what releases the slaves. V'yadua shemitzvas hatkia b'yom zeh. He lefarsim cherus kol evet ivri. The mitzvah of tekiyas shofar is to publicize the fact that all the Hebrew slaves are supposed to go free.
No, I can understand how. Right. That's right, of course.
She yetze ben chorin b'li damim. He doesn't have to pay anything. He goes free with no strings attached. Vein in yana k'inyan tekiyas shofar b'Rosh Hashanah. It's a different theme from the sounding of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Shatkiya hahi on Rosh Hashanah anu osem likboa macha shavtenu al inyan akedas Yitzchak. The point of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is to remind us of the binding of Isaac. Unetzayir ben avshenu lasos gam banu kamohu la'avas Hashem. The point is that we're supposed to remind ourselves to love God as much as Yitzchak Avinu loved God, that he was prepared to serve as his father's korban during the episode of Akedas Yitzchak. Again, we'll go into more detail later, but you know there are many reasons why we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. One is reminiscent of Akedas Yitzchak. The Rambam, of course, has the famous statement that even though blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is simply a commandment of God and we have to do it, but nevertheless, he gives his own little Shershei HaMitzvah, as we say in the Sefer Chinuch terminology, in the Hilchos Tshuva in the Rambam, that he says it's like an alarm clock. Shofar is like an alarm clock. Uru yishenim yishenaschem, that people who are sleeping and they're not paying attention to what they're doing. Some people just sleep through life. You know, they do whatever is that comes easiest. They do whatever they're used to. They do whatever they've gotten the habit of doing, and they don't wake up, so to speak, and realize that they could be doing something wrong, and they have to constantly be working on themselves and constantly improving. And the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a blast that goes. You know, and you're supposed to wake up and realize and think about what you're doing as opposed to keeping on the path of least resistance. Okay.
So the shofar is blown in shul, so the people that need the wake-up call the most are not there to hear it.
I mean, it doesn't have to be blown in shul.
Oh, no.
The shofar is, everybody has to listen to shofar. People who can't make it to shul, you have to hear shofar anyway.
I'm not talking about people who can make it, but people who simply don't go to shul.
Well, okay, so people are not interested, people don't believe in God, and they're not going to...
But the point is that they're the ones that have to be
woken
up.
Yeah, but they're not going to be woken up anyway. Uh-huh. People who are in a coma are not going to be woken up by an alarm clock. It's only people who are, you know, nicely sleeping, who are relevant to the... who have a shaycha, so to speak, to the world of the waking people, who are going to be woken up by alarm clocks. Okay. Kilomar, you could be so far gone that it's not going to help. Kilomar sheniya umitoch kach yale zichroneinu lifnei Hashem letov. And since we prepare ourselves that we're willing to submit to God with as unquestioningly and as fully as Yitzchak Avinu did, so that's going to cause our remembrance to go up to God, and He's going to remember us for good and inscribe us in the Book of Life. Kolomar shinei zakoim lefanav will be considered to be pure and blameless in front of him because we have decided that we're going to copy the total submission of Yitzchak Avinu. V'zos hatkiya shel yovel hilafarsa macherus kemo shamarnu. But that's not the theme of the shofar that's blown in the yovel. Rather, that's to declare the freedom of the slaves. Mishorshei mitzvah, the reasoning is as follows: Levishiyadua ki kol shofar to'or lebnei adam im l'shalom im l'melchama. That the nature of the blast of the shofar catches people's attention. It wakes up people's hearts that they pay attention to things. So whether it's for peaceful reasons or for war, we know that in the ancient world, so a call to battle was often done by way of a shofar blast. V'inyan shiluach ha'eved she'avad es Adonav zman rav hu kasha me'od be'inei Adonav. So if you have this slave who has been working for you for 49 years, right? Because remember, an Eved Ivri is normally supposed to go out after 7 years, but we have this ceremony that if an Eved Ivri wants to remain in his master's domain, then he goes to the doorpost and you make a hole in the ear at the doorpost. They have the whole thing that we discussed in Parshas Mishpatim, which was many mitzvahs ago. It's difficult, so you get used to each other, you know? The slave, the owner has been living with his slave, basically, for 49 years, and now he has to let him go free. The shofar is supposed to wake people up to realize that whether you like it or not, you must perform this mitzvah of letting your slaves go free. So the fact that everybody's blowing the shofar, and if you walk down the street, you hear this shul blowing the shofar, and that shul blowing the shofar, or that whatever, they're blowing shofar for this guy in his house, all the people are blowing shofar, it reminds you that everyone's in it together. So we were commanded to do this. Human nature. That one thing that encourages people and strengthens them to do something is peer pressure. Yeah. So if you get the idea that everyone's doing it, you're going to do it yourself. So everybody's doing it together, so it's somewhat easier than if you have to go against the stream that nobody else is doing it, and only you are doing it. Becomes much easier. So if they go, well, I'm freeing my slaves, like God said, so the one person who's the holdout and saying, well, I'm not going to free my slaves, is going to be pressured to realize that he has to do it.
Wait a second, though. Aren't the slaves legally freed whether the guy says he wants to do it or not? I mean, it's not
right. Yes, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. What?
Isn't that what it says next, that the slave himself is...
Not exactly. What he's saying is that it doesn't really matter, that the slave automatically goes free, kind of like the... there's the same shaila, sort of, as, in the Shemitah year. So you have the fruit. The fruit is supposed to be hefker. All the produce of the land is supposed to be hefker. So the shaila is it your mitzvah to make it hefker? But if you don't make it hefker and invite everyone to take, then it still remains yours, and if somebody actually takes it, that person is stealing, even though you did something wrong.
Really?
Or is it what's called Afkata de Malka? Afkata de Malka, which means that God declares it ownerless, so therefore, even if you put a fence around your farm on the Shemitah year, which you're not supposed to do, it's perfectly within anybody else's rights to scale the fence, get into the orchard, and take the fruit for free, because God said that all of this is free. So the pashtus is the same thing would be over here, that when you have a slave, and so God said he's supposed to go free. So whether or not the owner sets him free is irrelevant. He's going to go free anyway. But first of all, there is a minority opinion that if you don't actually set the slave free, then the slave doesn't go free. That's number one. And number two is that in theory it's possible for you to lock the slave up in a cage and not let him go. Even if God says he can go free, and if you don't physically let him, the things that the Torah talks about, they're not necessarily always extremely common, but nevertheless, it wasn't unheard of, so we have to have rules for it. Like having more than one wife. That it was, we know that on a Deraisa level, Darbana level, it's completely permissible for a man to have more than one wife. But even before Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom that explicitly forbade it, it was pretty uncommon for a man to have more than one wife.
None of Chazal had more than one wife, did they?
Oh.
I believe it's not recorded explicitly. I mean,
at the same time.
Well, right, at the same time.
Otherwise it doesn't count.
Right, of course. Of course, if it's at different times, then it's allowed. But it's not explicitly recorded. Unless you, there might have been certain instances of what's called temporary marriage. But okay, that's not necessarily what we're talking about.
Like the Iranians have
them. It might have been something like that. But yeah, it's not really recorded. I mean, the Gemara in Yevamos is rife with examples of people who had more than one wife. I mean, theoretical examples, but you get the impression that it actually happened. occasionally, but it was not very common to have more than one wife at a time, even at a time where it was a completely halachically and customarily permissible.
But now that the Pesach of Rabbi Abayashi Gershon has expired, what is the status of a second wife?
Well, first of all, that's a shaila. Some say that Rabbeinu Gershom only created this rule till the year 5000. So that was 778 years ago, the year 5000. So according to many, the official cherem expired in that year. Others disagree with that. But even if that is true, so even if the official cherem has expired, most Jewish communities have voluntarily adopted on themselves the standard that a man is not allowed to have more than one wife.
Yeah, but when Yemenite...
The Yemenites are not... They never did this. They never agreed to this.
Yeah, Rabbeinu Gershom was Ashkenazi.
Yeah, for sure, the cherem only applied to Ashkenazi communities. Most Sephardi communities who had contact with the Ashkenazi communities adopted this minhag, if not the official Takanos Rabbeinu Gershom, but the Yemenites never heard of this.
Yeah.
Never heard of this. So, So till the founding of the State of Israel, so Yemenites, sometimes they came to Israel with more than one wife. So even though under the law of the State of Israel, it's illegal to have more than one wife, nevertheless, they were grandfathered in. And they were there, they were recognized by the civil and religious authorities in Israel as having more than one wife, since they were married already. So what do you mean?
It's not that they forgot divorce, they had to do child support or whatever.
What do you mean?
If they got divorced from one wife...
Why would they want to do that? Maybe they lived happily as family. Maybe these two women were best friends. They wanted to...
In the course of nature, in the course of nature, I mean, it could occasionally happen that they wanted to get divorced from one of them.
Of course, yeah, sure.
Then gets hit for child support, even though he's...
Probably get child support anyway, whether you're married or not.
Even though he's... Right, even though he's... Right. Okay, but in Sephardi communities, is actually very interesting that since they didn't officially have the cherem, so it was just sort of customary not to have more than one wife, so they'd be afraid that people would be a little lax about it. So they actually used to... I mean, I think they still do, actually, in some communities. They write it into the ksuba. That here, the groom agrees that, you know, he's taking this young lady as a wife, and he promises her and her father and her family that he will never take a second wife more than this, in addition to this young Sephardic lady that he is marrying. Okay. But let's say in a situation also where a woman, let's say, is insane, and she's living in a mental institution, and... She obviously doesn't get a say in such a situation. So, and then the sister-in-law. So, in such a situation, the man would be within his rights to seek a heter me'er rabbanim, which would allow him to take a second wife anyway. Yeah. But the question is, in a situation of yibum, and he wants to marry his sister-in-law, so would he even need a heter me'er rabbanim? That's part of the cheshbon. Okay. It's like a wise person once said, the pain of a multitude is a comfort. So when everybody's in it together, it's not even just peer pressure. Right, misery loves company. That's how you say it in English. So if everybody's in it together, so it's going to make easier for people to undergo this trial and slight suffering and unhappiness. Remember, so this slave didn't go out in 7 years. And Eved Ivri is supposed to leave after 7 years. But what happens when he gets his ear pierced? When he says, "Ahavti es Adoni," he says, "I love my master. This is a great time. You know, maybe my master is a billionaire, and you know, I stole some money from him and I owed him, so I became his Eved Ivri, and he feeds me." You know, he feeds me steak every night, so I'm very happy to remain in my master's household, and he treats me very well. So that's why he remained a slave for so long. Again, you could imagine a situation where you know you become an Evrid Ivri 1 year before Yovel, so therefore you don't necessarily love your master, but somebody who's been working there for a while. And he's an Evrid Ivri at the time of the Yovel. So normally he's going to have said already. You know, I love my master. I don't want to go free. So he likes being there. Nevertheless, he has to go free.
Well,
yeah?
What happens if, okay, so the master...
Umitoch kach hamitzvah miskayemes lashuv hakol birshus adon hakol. Because the point of the Jubilee year is that everything goes back to being in God's possession, so to speak, as opposed to individual possession. So everyone's supposed to be owned by the correct parties. So an eved, we know that really that being an eved for so long is not ideal. That okay, you get steak every night, but the truth is, it's a wrong hashkafa, because you're supposed to serve only God, and you're not supposed to serve other human beings. So therefore, if you even if you extended your stay as an Eved Ivri, there's still a limit, and you go out at the Jubilee year. Dinei HaMitzvah, the halachos are as follows. Kigon be'eze shofar tokin b'yom zeh. What kind of shofar do you use in this day? Ve'ezo bracha mevarchin bo, and what type of bracha you say on it this day? Chor amru zichron al bracha derachal v'maseches Rosh Hashanah shav ha'yov al Rosh Hashanah l'tikiel rachas. So the blowing of the shofar ceremony on Yovel, on Yom Kippur, is exactly the same as on Rosh Hashanah. You use the same type of shofar, which is a... It doesn't have to be... I mean, there's a huge machlokes rishon about this, about exactly what type of shofar is acceptable. But basically, the basic halacha is that any animal horn that has a piece inside that can be taken out and you're left with a shofar is acceptable as a shofar, as opposed to like a deer horn. So a deer horn is a solid piece. Oh. So you could, you know, hollow it out and make some sort of rudimentary instrument, but a ram's horn or a goat horn, for example, has two parts. It has like an inner bone, and then there's a cartilage covering of that, so you just slip the shofar off the cartilage, the cartilage covering off the inner part. Oh. And you have your shofar. So it's not we on Rosh Hashanah use a ram's horn because of the Akedas Yitzchak, because it's more reminiscent of the binding of his Isaac, who was saved by a ram. But technically, according to most opinions of the Rambam, so other shofars are acceptable on Rosh Hashanah, and they would be acceptable on Yovel as well. So the brachas is that on Yom Kippur of Yovel, you have the Musaf with 9 brachas, the same way you have on Rosh Hashanah. So the longest Shmoneh Esrei of the year is on Rosh Hashanah, because you have the first 3 brachas, then you have Malchios, the kingship of God, then Zichronos, the remembrances, then the Shofros, the verses that talk about the blowing of the Shofar. So it makes sense, because it's connected to the blowing of the Shofar. And this Musaf would be davened on Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year, as well, obviously substituting the psukim that talk about the korban musaf of Yom Kippur and saying Melech al kol haaretz mikadesh Melech melchel v'solech la'avon Hoseinu ma'aviras Moshe Ash Moseinu v'chol shana v'shana Melech al kol haaretz mikadesh Yisrael v'yom ha'kippurim, that you have the regular the liturgical parts for Yom Kippur substituting for the liturgical parts of Rosh Hashanah, but everything would be the same. You would have the blowing of the shofar during Chazaras Hashatz, during the Shemoneh Esrei, the same way you have it on Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, you're used to thinking about it, so you can imagine that if we had all the... In the olden days, in the time the Yovel was actually applicable, so it's funny, actually, I just thought of this, that this was all theoretical, because Yovel wasn't applicable since the time of the first Beis Hamikdash, and then they didn't have the exact liturgy that we have nowadays. So it's funny that, I don't know, did they used to do this in the times of Bayasheni when, during the Yovel year, even though the Yovel wasn't relevant, nevertheless, did they say it anyway, like as a remembrance? I'm not exactly sure, but when was this actually practiced? What do you mean? The Jubilee year was not actually practiced since the times of Bayis Rishon, because the Jubilee only is in effect when all the tribes of the Jewish people are dwelling in their proper places in Eretz Yisrael.
In their proper places?
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, the times of Bayis Sheni, according to the Rambam, they counted the Jubilee year. In other words, they used to do 7 cycles of Shemitah, then they would say, hey, it's a Jubilee year now, although nothing would happen.
Right.
It wasn't practiced. They would just say, hey, it's a Jubilee year, and then
able to work the land in the 50th
year.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I think none of the halachos were applicable. It was just, you know, hey, this is supposed to be the this is supposed to be the yovel. We don't find anywhere the yovel is the rabbanon in a time, you know, when it's not applicable. Either it's applicable or it's not. Shavuos, we find that it's applicable the rabbanon.
By the way, is it was it an obligation of everybody? Do you have to hear the shofar and yovel like you do on yovel?
Yes. Yes, at that time.
Whether you had slaves or didn't have slaves.
Right, at that time it was absolutely obligatory on anyone. But you could just imagine, so nowadays, if we had this, so we would have on the Musaf Yom Kippur during Chazaras HaShatz, we'd have Malchios Zichrono Shofros, we have the Avoda, we have all the Putim, we have Eila Ezkera, it would be twice as long.
No break.
Yeah, they have to reduce the length of the other Tulas maybe. So we have to reduce the number of other putim that would be said. Otherwise, it simply wouldn't be time for everything. It was just interesting to think of what would be if it were applicable nowadays that we have all these things. Okay, but the seder of the tkiyas would be the same. That on a deraisa level, it goes. You have to hear three sets of three. In other words, you hear. Tkia trua tkia, tkia trua tkia, tkia trua tkia. That's the deraisa you have to hear on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur of Yovel.
Who said that? I mean, whose idea was it that it has to be three times?
It's learned out because it says Taviru shofar b'chol artzechem. So it implies from that Taviru shofar means that there's supposed to be before and after the trua, it's supposed to be a tkia. It's learned out in Maseches Rosh Hashanah. They discuss exactly how it's derived from all the biblical verses. So, of course, we know that nowadays we don't know exactly what a trua is, whether it's what we call Shvarim trua, whether it's what we call Shvarim or what we call trua. So, therefore, we do all of them. We do all of them. That means, so instead of hearing nine blasts, which is the strict deraisa requirement, we now hear 30 blasts.
100.
And, yeah, 100. Okay, we get to 100 because of we added the minhag of blowing after Shmon Esrei, and, of course, we have to blow in the middle of Shmon Esrei as well. In a time where we know exactly what a trua is, so and everything is good, so the only shofar blowing is the one during Chazaras HaShatz.
Oh, yeah.
There are three blasts after Malchios, three blasts after Zichronos, and three blasts after Shofaros. That's nine. It's just because of various extraneous reasons that we have such a large number of shofar blasts nowadays. And of course, nowadays we have more sfeikus that we don't know exactly. There's a machlokis about whether the shvarim trua is supposed to be blown with one breath or two breaths. So that's why we do both of those. There's also a disagreement about how long the Shvarim is supposed to be held. The machlok is between Rashi and Tosis that according to Rashi, a Shever is very short. So the Shvarim would be two, 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 something like that. That's it.
So if you really want to be Mekayim all the Shitas, then how many colors would you need?
You could be doing it a whole year.
Rav Moshe Sternbuch, in his Sefer Moedim Muzmanim, where he has nice halachic essays about the holidays. So he has a sheet there where he lists, if you want to be Yotzi, all the sheetas about blowing shofar, how you should do it. I don't think he gets every single one even in there. If you want all the permutations, because then if you have a disagreement about what a trua sounds like, so and you have to do regular trua and shvarim trua, and shvarim trua in one breath, and shvarim trua in two breaths. So you have, if you really want every single permutation, there are a lot of shofar blowing that you'll be doing on Rosh Hashanah, but we don't have to do every single one. We just try to do the basic ones. The one thing I like is that in the trua, there is a major difference of minhagim in the different Jewish communities, that in the Sephardic communities and most Eastern European Jewish communities, the trua goes ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. But in the Western Ashkenazi communities, in Germany, France, and in the Yemenite communities, interesting that they're together on this, the trua goes, it's one long warbling sound. It's not, you know, a staccato series of blasts. So that, I think, it's definitely worthwhile. And again, I'm not necessarily in favor of hearing every single permutation. Everything is a single shita. But that one, since it's a very major difference, there's an argument. There are slight variations in how the shvarim sound, for example. So you could argue that it's not ma'akev, that either one is maybe technically kosher, but since the trua is so different, then it could be argued that if one is correct, then you're not yotzei with the other. Yeah.
So Breuer's does it our way, the last brother calls then, right?
Breuer's has an interesting history about this. Breuer's, the real show trua for Breuer's is supposed to be, but their Baal Tokea, who started a very long time ago, didn't know how to do it well. So Rabbi Breuer told him to do the other way trua. So that's why they have two Balei Tkia. Oh. So one, they switch off. The first day, one does the beginning through the end of Shimon Esrei, and one does the blasts after. And then they switch for the second day, so that on each day, they'll at least hear at one point the real Yekesha Truas of...
How interesting.
Yeah, but there's what to be said for both of those opinions. Although... many Rishonim, although the Shulchan Aruch doesn't really paskin like this, but many Rishonim say that when we say that we don't know which is the right trua, so therefore we do them all, and that's how we ended up with 30 blasts instead of 9. And then, of course, further, as the generations went on, they say, no, it doesn't really mean that you're not yotzei with the other trua. It doesn't mean that you don't really know what the trua is. That what the Torah means is that any staccato or warbling type of sound is a trua, and any flat blast is a tkia. So whether you go tu-tu-tu-tu, or doesn't really matter. You yotzei with all of them, either of them on a deraisa level are called a trua. But nevertheless, there were different communities that had different minhagim about how to do it, and they would say, no, ours is the right way to do shofar, you're not yotzei. The other ones say, ours is the right way to do shofar, you're not yotzei. That's why Rebbe Avahu, it says in the Gemara, established the practice that we have to do all of them, not because he was nervous that we wouldn't be yotzei because we wouldn't do the right one, but in order to make sure that each community did all of them so they realize that they're all correct.
Oh,
so that's why I think, based on that reasoning, so that's why I think that it's also important to do the warbling trua, in order to get the message across that they're all correct. Mm. Okay? And then you have so many to spare, so you know, why do the same ones over again? You might as well get another sheet in. You know?
Keep the congregation's attention.
Yeah.
Which by this time it's probably had an overdose.
Right. Yeah, no, it does. It does to a certain extent.
Diminishing returns.
Yeah. Shofar Seder Pinchas. Nedaber bo k'tas be'ezras Hashem. We'll talk about this more when we get to the mitzvah blowing shofar. K'min again, we call on Rosh Hashanah. When we come up, come off a bish. Amr zichron levracha sheshavin hein. Even though the Chazal said they're the same, chiluk k'tas yesh b'nei. There's a little different. The Rosh Hashanah shechal yos b'Shabbes lo hayu tokin ela b'bezdin. On Rosh Hashanah, when it falls on Shabbos, they would only blow in the main rabbinical court. Because the main rabbinical court, they for sure no one was going to be mechal Shabbos to bring the shofar. I don't want 70 rabbis with white beards. You know, like, you just brought in the shofar? They're all screaming at him at once. You just brought in the shofar on Shabbos? Oh my gosh. So nobody would even think to do that. But in a regular shul, so people are more less intimidating and imposing. And if somebody forgot and carried the shofar, then that would be no good. That's very interesting. One of the examples, the Chazal said that we should not fulfill a mitzvah deraisa. We should refrain from fulfilling a mitzvah deraisa in order to prevent violation of Shabbos by carrying the shofar in Rishus Harabim. That's very interesting. So that this is in a lot of places. That's why we don't take the lulav on Shabbos. That's why we don't read the Megillah on Shabbos when Purim falls on Shabbos. Because of this concern that we might violate Shabbos by carrying these mitzvah items in the Rishus Harabim. Uviyovel tokea kol yachid v'yachid kol zman shebezdin yoshvin. And in Yovel, so anybody can blow the shofar as long as the bezdin is in session. Bein bifnei bezdin, bein shelo bifneihem. So on the Yom Kippur of Yovel, we don't have this gzera, at least as stringently, that since it's so unusual, I guess, so people pay more attention to it, So you're allowed to blow the shofar on the Yom Kippur of Yovel when it falls on Shabbos. I mean, it always falls on Yom Kippur, right?
Yeah, you only have one day.
Right.
It's not like Rosh Hashanah, you got 2 days.
Right, it doesn't really help you necessarily, because nowadays the real mitzvah, the rice of shofar, is on the first day, and that's the one that can fall on Shabbos, according to our calendar, even though I always say that I wouldn't mind if Yom Kippur could, if Rosh Hashanah could fall on Friday. If Yom Kippur fell on Friday, then you'd only have 2 day yontifs and not 3 day yontifs. You reduce the load of 3 day yom tovim for when Rosh Hashanah falls on Thursday. But then you have the problem that if Rosh Hashanah fell on Friday, so Yom Kippur would fall on Sunday, which in the olden days would have been a terrible hardship. Nowadays, with refrigerators, so who cares? It'd be totally fine if Yom Kippur fell on Sunday, because you wouldn't have to prepare food anyway. Fine. So Yom Kippur. So this doesn't make sense, right? To uproot the mitzvah entirely, basically, because Yom Kippur you're not allowed to carry anyway, so it wouldn't help you. Rosh Hashanah, most of the time you're allowed to carry. When it falls on Shabbos, you're not allowed to carry. So it wouldn't really help you you can't completely eliminate the mitzvah. It's the famous Taz says that Chazal are not allowed to completely uproot a mitzvah. They could say in certain years don't fulfill it, but if they say, you know, never blow the shofar on Shabbos never blow the shofar on Shana because maybe you'll get confused and carry when you fall on Shabbos, so that they're not allowed to do. Yeah, right. But they can say that in certain times refrain from blowing the shofar on Shabbos. V'chein midinei mitzvah. Further halachas are as follows. Gemach amrizir on the bracha. Ki merosh Hashanah v'ad yom ha-kippurim ayu avodim ochlim v'shosin usmeichim v'veis adonam. So, again, this is assuming that the image that's presented here is of a slave who's happy to be leaving. And so from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, even though normally it's a relatively serious time in the Jewish calendar, so here the slaves used to eat and drink and enjoy themselves on their master's account, basically. They deserve it, all the years of free labor, so they used to eat and drink. So during those 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so they would neither be totally free, they will not go home, but on the other hand also, the master would not work them. So when Yom Kippur came around, the Bezdin would blow the shofar, and they would go home. If they could get home on Yom Kippur in a permissible manner, they could go home on Yom Kippur. But if they was outside the Tchum, for example, so then they would have to wait till after Yom Kippur. Uchmochein sodos chozros lebalehen. Same thing too. The fields would go back to the original owners. Rabbi miprate dine yovel be'erchen v'dine shofar masechas Rosh Hashanah. This is found in masechas Erchen, and specifically the shofar rules are found in masechas Rosh Hashanah. V'noheges b'tzozo be'eretz Yisrael. Bizman Shayovel Noheg, at the times of the Jubilee year is relevant, so this is only in Eretz Yisrael. Verikasati lach besamuch, ezizman Yovel Noheg, when all the Jews are living in the proper places. The Shemitzos Yovel Mesur LeBezdin. Depends on the Bezdin. Vim Avru, I mean, it's given over to Bezdin to make sure it's done properly. Vim Avru Bezdin, Al Zevelotako Beshofar, Avabish, Nishtalch Vavod, and the Uchzur Asadus, the Valem, Bilihat Kia. So you might think that if they don't blow the shofar, but nevertheless, everybody observes Yovel properly, so okay, no big deal. This shofar was supposed to remind people to observe the mitzvah of Yovel, and they did it anyway, so they didn't need the shofar. No, but it's a separate mitzvah, bitlu mitzvah saseizeh. Nevertheless, that's considered to be a sin.
It's
a separate mitzvah, independent.
After Yom Kippur, we blow the shofar, is that like also remember the,
That's just the minhag. Yeah, it's not, it's to announce. I mean, there are different reasons for that. Yeah, people think that it announces the end of the fast, which in some communities it does, but not necessarily so. In Eretz Yisrael, they are makbid in a lot of places to finish ne'ilah while it's still daytime. That our minhag is to be lenient to finish ne'ilah even into the night.
Why is that mean?
Because we're not insistent to finish it before.
Oh, I see.
But so for us, when we blow the shofar, so it's the fast is usually
over.
and I've started to insist on this in previous years, that we blew the show for like a few minutes before the announced time, and people are saying, "What? The fest is over? It's not over. You said it ends at 7:43. You blew the show for at 7:41. How could this be?" I said, "Okay, fine. We'll blow the show for now. Only after the fast is over." What?
Are you allowed to blow
it? You're allowed to, because the blowing of the shofar is only derabanan. So therefore, you don't have to wait until the same zman that you would have to wait for eating and drinking, for example, on Motzei Yom Kippur, which are deraisa. So yeah. So the truth is, we finish in the Ila and our shul, the main part of Neil, and then we have Avinu Akenu and the Kaddish and the shofar, etc. afterwards. But the truth is, in our shul, we finish Ne'ilah usually before a time that might Me'ikar Hadin be considered to be Tzeis. Wouldn't rely on that for Motzei Yom Kippur for eating and drinking, but maybe it's considered to be Tzeis. So therefore, you could argue that we're Makba in our shul also to finish Ne'ilah while it's still daytime. But in Eretz Yisrael, so some shuls, I don't think this would fly in our shul, but in some shuls they go way late with Ne'ilah. They could be still in Ne'ilah for 45 minutes and after the fast is over. Okay, people are not in a rush always to eat Motzei Yom Kippur. They're on a spiritual high, so they want to keep going with the Ne'ilah. There's a mitzvah Tosefis.
But isn't it that you can't daven Ne'ilah after Tzeis?
Well, you have to start while it's still daytime, that's true, but you're not allowed, but according to some opinions, you're allowed to continue in Ne'ilah as late as you want into the night. Yeah, but in Eretz Yisrael, and most places are makbid to finish Nila when it's really still daytime, it's still light out. So then they blow the shofar right afterwards, even if it's like right after Shkia, sunset, which I don't really go for.
Next,
I mean, they have a shir until Maariv.
How weird.
For many reasons. I think that there are problems with that. I think that the way
confusing.
Yeah, exactly.
A is confusing, and B, I think it's not good mood-wise for the end of Yom Kippur to be like, okay, we finished Ne'ilah, now we have to wait till Maariv. It's better to go straight from Ne'ilah into Maariv. And it's also a huge, huge chumrah, which may be a chumrah da'asi l'deikula, which leads to a leniency to finish Ne'ilah by what we call sunset. Because even according to the opinions that you have to finish Ne'ilah while it's still daytime, maybe hold that you have until Tzeis. You have until Tzeis HaKochavim, and you don't have to finish by sunset. Second of all, if you makbid to finish by what we call sunset, you end up starting the Ne'ilah very early, which is also a cool idea. In Ne'ilah is supposed to be Davin, well, you have the impression that the, is it say in NCSY, is Yom Kippur ebbs away. Supposed to be getting a little dark out, shadows, it's approaching, you can feel that Yom Kippur is almost over.
Yeah.
But if it's still extremely light out, the sun is shining very brightly, and you're davening Ne'ilah, it doesn't have the right feel, and halachically, it could be too early. So that's why I think the way that we do it is actually better, but in Eretz Yisrael, they have this approach. Okay? Well, okay. So the Mitzvah Kiddush Shnas HaYovel, Shin Lamed Beis. 332. Mitzvah Kiddush Shnas HaYovel, Akadish Shnas HaChamishim, Kemo Shnas HaShmita. So we have to sanctify the 50th year like the Shemitah year. Kelomar Bebitol HaVoda Ba'aretz. The Hefker Hatzomeachba. The same thing. We don't work the land, and we have to treat all the produce as ownerless. Shenemar, Vikidashta, Meshnasa Chamishim Shana, you sanctify the 50th year. Veirakosu, Shimna Kedusha, Hushu Periseut, Vosen Nifkarim, the same Mishmita. All the fruit is free and ownerless. Vishyuha Vodim Yotsimitachas Yata Adon. That's not Mishmita, obviously. That all the slaves go free. Shamarakosu, Acherkein, Ukrosim, Dror Baritzachal Yoshveha. You shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. Shit the Kalomar, Cherus Lavadim, freedom for slaves, Giovel he, Kodesh Tielochem in Asudetochus Tibuasa, Kalomar Shatia to Atua Hefker below Yasua, Kolecha Vechadur Shuso. Okay, it says explicitly in the Pasuk. Mishorsha Mitzvah, Mashikasavti, Mitzvah's Minyan Ashanim. The reasoning is, as we said, in the midst of counting the years, Mitzvah Rishona, Shivarsha Zo. Shiratza Hashem Lizakos Amo beKabbalas Malchuso, that he wanted the Jewish people to accept his kingship, that ultimately he owns the land, God owns the land, and not any individual person. Kimoshi Kasafti Shakti Sham the Khan Hayamikomo. Okay, also here. Vidini Amitzah, it's even more correct to do it here. It's just that mitzvah came first, so I talked about it over there instead of over here. Midini Amitzah Mashamizikhan Rakha Shikos Azur Bashana Shriyas. Me'avod asaretz aser b'yovel. Anything that's aser on Shemitah is aser on Yovel, kol shemutar ba mutar ba. Anything that you're allowed to do to work the land on Shemitah is mutar on Yovel as well. V'achiyuv ala oseh shav b'shneyam. So you get malkus for both of them. V'dina peros b'achil v'mechir abir shav b'neyam. And the rules of the fruit that they have to be eaten with called Kedusha Shvias or Kedusha Yovel. In this case, they're not allowed to waste them. They have to be entirely eaten. They're not allowed to be thrown out. They can be, if you have leftovers, they have to be left to rot until they're totally inedible before you throw them out, because you're not allowed to throw out the holy fruit. You're not allowed to waste it in any way. Of in the Chira, you're not allowed to sell them. I mean, let's sell small amounts. Maybe you're not allowed to make a store out of it. Uvevir shave bishneihem. And the fact that they both have to be what's called destroyed, even though according to the vast majority of shitas, it doesn't literally mean that they have to be destroyed, but rather that if you have a small amount, you have the perishvias that you took for yourself, they originally hefker. So before at the time that this species is no longer found in the fields, you're supposed to take the produce outside your house and say, this is hefker, and that's called being mevirit, it's called destroying it, and then at that point, you could take it back in. Yeah, most the Rambam is a singular opinion that you actually have to destroy it. You're not allowed to do this. But we follow the shitas that you're allowed to just declare it ownerless and bring it back in. Yisera shviyas ala yovel shehi mishametes ksofim v'davka besofa. So one thing that's in Shemitah that's not in Yovel is the canceling of debts. So that happens during a Shemitah year, but not during a Yovel year. And that happens at the end of a Shemitah year. The cancellation of debts is at the end. B'yes or Yovel HaShviyas, so Yovel has halachas that are not applicable in Shviyas. Shemeshamit karka umotzi avodim uvitchilasa. That the fields go back to the original owners, and the slaves go free, and it's not at the end, but at the beginning. Shnas Yovel eino ole miminyan shnei hashavua. El amon en teshav arbaim shana shein sheva shanim sheva pa'amim v'achar shnas hashmita shi b'shvi achron osin sheyovel b'shnas hachamishim. O shnas echas achas v'chamishim asfil mimnos yovel achar v'yatchil haskola shei shanim shal shavua. We mentioned last time that there's a disagreement in the Gemara as to whether the Yovel counts as a year of the Shemitah cycle or not. That is, we paskin like Rabbanan. The Rabbanan say that, at least at a time where the Yovel is practiced, that it's a block of 50 years. It's seven Shemitah cycles, the 50th year is Yovel, then the next year is year one. So the Shemitah, the Yovel always comes after the seventh Shemitah. But according to Rabbi Huda, the other Shita, so Yovel floats around. That the first Yovel is year one of the Shemitah cycle, and then the next time will be year two, etc. Okay. In a time where all the Jews live in Eretz Yisrael at the proper places that they're supposed to be. That I think what probably used to happen is that at the time where the New Year was sanctified on Rosh Hashanah, so they used to get together. They would say, this is the Shemitah year, the Yovel year, and they would blow the shofar. So everyone also had to blow privately. You could hear the shofar everywhere. Everybody's blowing shofar at around the same time. Shofar, 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 shofar. And the slaves go to their houses, and the fields go back to their owners. And if you violate this and you work the ground in the Yovel, a type of impermissible labor. If you didn't want to send your slave free, you neglected to perform this positive commandment. And you also violated a negative commandment, as we'll see later on. You're not allowed to work the land. That whenever you have these cycles, so cycles, he was talking before about the mystical significance of the number seven. So you have cycles that show God's control over nature. That's why in Judaism, vis-a-vis one's relationship to the Jewish people, one of the biggest sins, the biggest sin in certain ways, is violating Shabbos. I guess Avodah Zarah also. Avodah Zarah is bad also, but it's only Shabbos and Avodah Zarah that if you violate those mitzvos, you're considered basically to be not Jewish for ritual purposes. One still remains, you know, genetically, ethnically Jewish, that if one had a child, you know, the woman especially, the child would still be Jewish. But for ritual purposes, someone who engages in these two sins, even if you keep every other mitzvah in the Torah, it's hard to imagine how that would be, but even if you keep every other mitzvah in the Torah, then you would not count as a Jew. If you blew the shofar for someone, they wouldn't be yotze. If you, you know, you really shouldn't count for a minyan. You really, you get the idea.
You have to give your wife a get.
Yeah. For again, ethnic relationship purposes, okay. The marriage and divorce are still.
That's actually pretty tricky because if you get them to do it.
It's a question nowadays. You know, people are. It's really talking about. Again, you really do lose your status for ritual purposes, but there are some people who are more lenient regarding people who don't keep Shabbos because they don't know any better, as opposed to trying to rebel against God. So again, it's exactly questionable. It's questionable exactly where you draw the line.
You hold by the Arab and somebody else doesn't hold by the Arab, and that makes you not Jewish because you're not...
No, something that you believe... It's talking about someone who doesn't believe in Shabbos.
Okay.
It also says there's some people who say that if you privately don't... Yeah, it's really called Mechal Shabbos b'farhesia, that privately you keep... You don't keep Shabbos, but let's say, you know, you'd be embarrassed to violate Shabbos in front of a big rabbi... Or publicly, neighbors. Mm-hmm. If you publicly keep Shabbos and you keep a lid on it and you keep the other mitzvahs and you're generally part of a Jewish community, so you would not necessarily be subject to this stringency. We have very awkward things where you don't know exactly where to draw the line. If somebody should count for a minyan or not, somebody shows up to your shul. It's not so pashut, but it's basically these things. So it's like Yovel, although we don't have a specific thing that says if you violate Yovel, so you're considered to be like not Jewish for ritual purposes. Nevertheless, it's still considered hashkafically among one of the worst sins because it shows that you don't believe in God's full ownership over the world and the fact that He created it ex nihilo.